Hi, everybody from Southeast Asia. It's great to be here. I am Art Bell, and filling in this night for George Noy. And I know George and I disagree on the whole global warming thing, and that's fine. That's, you know, what a good network ought to be all about, and that is both sides of any question. Wouldn't you agree? Even if you disagree, wouldn't you agree? Lots of these. Fort Lauderdale, Florida, Art. Think of all the jobs that would be created to move society away from the coast. Just think of all the uninhabitable cold areas that would finally become habitable. I just can't wait till we grow coconut trees in Chicago. Bring on global warming. I can't wait. I've got so many of these, you wouldn't believe it. That's an attitude for you. We'll be back with Dr. Peter Ward in a moment. Shane from Dallas, Texas, suggests we call it the Gulf oil rupture. That kind of brings to mind a question. Dr. Ward, rupture, that's an interesting word. I've heard a number of reports that not just at the well site, but near the well site, within miles and miles, they are actually seeing ruptures in the seabed, and they're seeing stuff come up from these ruptures. Anything to that? What do you know?
I've heard the same reports. I found it interesting that two entirely different news sources cited unnamed government sources, anonymous government sources, government scientists who refused to name themselves. I mean, this is usually... You know, we scientists love, we don't get much hoo-ha-ha, and it's nice to hear see our name in the press once in a while, but the fact that every one of these was anonymous, somebody's putting a big lid on this. And Art, what have you heard about BP on the same vein that is buying up scientists down there and bribing them not to say anything? I'm getting reports along that line, too.
Well, I've also read those, but since you are a scientist and have a lot of friends working, in that area, I'm sure, you would know more about it than I would. Have you had any offers?
No, I'm too small a fish in this little business, I'm afraid. Oh, gosh, it's so unethical. The whole thing, it's just another heartbreak. In terms of the rupturing, you know, there's so much pressure. They went into this without really doing sort of due diligence on the technology. They should have known theoretically that you've got so much pressure when you're dealing with that many thousands of feet under the seabed, which is already under a mile of ocean. Come on, I mean, we're talking about some phenomenal pressure. And it just seemed to me that the chances of this sort of thing happening would be, I know we're not talking about one in a thousand. We're talking about kind of over and over and over. How often would you go flying if one out of every three airplanes fell out of the sky? Mm-hmm. Well, is that the scenario we have for deep water wells?
Well, again, it comes to mind that had we continued from the 1970s, we wouldn't have to be drilling in 5,000 and 10,000 feet of water to get oil that we desperately need.
You know, what scares me, Art, is that I had the great luck to spend a sabbatical in Australia. And Australia is a very hot place in a way, but they still have some cooler regions. But nevertheless, they have most of their country now is converting to roofs that have solar cells, or at least roofs that are white. Our science advisor told our president, why don't we just paint every roof in America light-colored, it would have a giant effect. It doesn't cost virtually anything. Not even that gets done.
I know. I'm truly puzzled. I really honestly am puzzled. And I guess it all, bottom line, it comes back to money, doesn't it? I mean, oil is really big money. And really big money finds a way to politicians. And when it does, then what big oil wants, big oil gets. And I have a feeling what they want is to use every last little bit of oil before we do anything else. Yes?
I get that same feeling. And the scary thing for me, I bashed the Bush administration earlier. I'm going to bash the Obama administration now. They're really losing, I think, an awful lot of credibility and independence. And the one thing that really struck me was that the Yucca nuclear repository in Nevada, Yucca Flats, they've decided to just scrap that. Now, we have to add nuclear to the mix. I hate to say it, but it's going to have to be one of the pieces. And yet, to go ahead and start building more nuclear plants without any sort of repository for the waste is insanity. And yet, that's
well, it is. In France, they deal with it. They do. Process.
I know they're good. It comes.
They process the waste. Why can't we do that? Why can't we do what France does?
Art, you tell me. I have no idea who, what. It just seems to me there are no grown-ups in charge in places at a moment in history that is so critical. I saw you. I went to your website. I saw that cutie. What a beautiful child.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, I've got a 13-year-old who's in the next room listening to this whole interview. He's going to stay up. He said, Dad, I'm not going to go to sleep. 4 hours. I said, no, I'm not going to sleep. But those are the future, and they deserve some grown-ups somewhere, dealing with this mess.
Well, like a modern-day Moses, you went away 40 days to a tent in Greenland. What was that like?
It was Antarctica, actually, and
Oh, you went to Antarctica? I thought it was Greenland. I'm sorry.
No, twice.
You went to the Antarctic, Mike.
We went right down across the Drake Passage, and we got to take Ramamine all the way down 5 days across the Drake, dropped off on a little island called James Ross.
Wow.
Nothing living. I was in the tent. I've never been in a situation where I was ever above freezing for so long. And every day we'd go out and do our work and we'd come back. And of course it never got dark, but it never got warm. And so before you got in your bag, we went out and actually run. So our body got warm enough to get in the down bags and just be able to stay warm enough. It's just so strange to live in a place where you never get above freezing. On the other hand, it's usually so much colder there that there's enough sunshine coming down that our campsite began to sink in the mud. It was used to be permafrost, and it's just going, gone. The place is melting all around you.
The Antarctic?
Yeah.
That was the one place that not a great deal. I mean, I knew about the ice shelf that split. I knew about perhaps trouble with the Ross ice shelf, but my God, you notice that much melting in the Antarctic?
Oh, absolutely. And the strange thing, I was down there with a guy named Eric Steig, who works at my university. Up until our trip, every continent had been known to be warming, but the skeptics said, except Antarctica. Except
right.
Steig has been down there 10 or 15 times on ice core drilling. And he published in Nature that the very week we first got down there, the cover of Nature was a picture of Antarctica showing that it, too, had warmed up. So he was brought out on the Senate floor by the senior senator from Oklahoma and accused of faking the data. And it was read into the Senate record. I mean, well, so we got this radio message, and by the way, you've been accused of faking it. But we're there. You just see it all around you. So here's the single scariest scenario is that what we have something called an ice sheet collapse. This is the West Antarctic ice sheet. This is the greatest pile of ice on land in the world. Except right. that the land is piled on, so a bunch of it's below sea level. This thing can break off in 10 years and cause 20 to 30 feet of sea level rise in 10 years. And there's no way you could even deal with that on an economic or a human scale. I mean, it would be a billion people dead. And we know this has happened. We can see it for the geological record. It has happened at times when you had short-term upturns of temperature. The last one was a million years ago, but the change that led to it was the warming, the CO2 increase, nothing like what we're doing now. It is the single greatest threat to our species, not for extinction, but for one of these, what do we call it, Art? A mortality pulse, a mass dying. There's got to be something, but that is the single greatest threat to us now is an ice sheet collapse on the WA, the Western Antarctic Ice Sheet.
And you're saying that would add how many feet?
Well, they're thinking of maybe it'd be only 10, but the thought is it'd be maybe 20 feet of sea level rise in 10 years at most or less. And so when you think about where agriculture is, how much agriculture, especially you in Asia know that rice growing does best in fertile soil right down low in sea level, where the rivers brought in the most productive material. The deltas of the world are the single most productive agricultural areas on the planet, the Ganges, the Brahmaputra, the Nile, the Mekong, I mean, on and on and on. That's where your rice is grown. Even a 3-foot sea level rise destroys, utterly destroys every single delta on this planet, and we will have 3 feet in at most 70 years. And my fear is in 40 years. I mean, this is what's facing us.
When Whitley Strieber and I wrote The Coming Global Superstorm, we suggested there could be rapid climate change, not slow, but rapid. And at the time, it got a lot of laughter. Since that time, there's been a lot of hard science suggesting that rapid climate change is not only possible, but probable. Yes?
Oh, absolutely. Look, you didn't hear me laughing, and you didn't hear the people I hang out with laughing, which are some pretty good climate people. Details can always be wrong, but concepts, in this particular case, you're absolutely right. And the ice cores have shown you were right. We've seen 10 degree centigrade changes in 10 years from the ice cores. 10 degrees doesn't sound like much until you realize that's the whole globe. That's everywhere. Let's see however hot it is in New York. It's 100 degrees. Oh, how did you like it to be 110 degrees instead? And there you go. Why am I laughing?
There you go. I don't know. Sometimes, you know, gallows humor is the only way you get through something. And still, I guarantee we will not get through to some of the people that are fast blasting me and emailing me. That's a pretty important question, Doctor. How do we get through to these people? How do we finally get through to them?
Well, I think there's, again, this concept of triage, and sometimes there will be people that you could never get to, and what we do instead is try to educate our kids. One of my big bugaboos right now is that just the level of illiteracy, science illiteracy in America. I spent a lot of time in the Philippines, actually. I work on the Chamber Nautilus, or I used to. I was at Dumaguete City. I was all through Negros, Cebu, and I just spent a long time. And I have an enormous sense of appreciation for the level of science literacy in the Philippines. Now,
it is amazing.
The U.S., it is amazing.
For a third world poor country, the literacy rate here is through the roof. It's unbelievable.
Well, it is, and I challenge we Americans to be as good as the Philippine people in understanding the relationship between humanity and nature and for reading. And so what I have been trying to do is just get to the kids. I mean, really get to the kids. And my kid, 13, what he loves are video games. Where I learned a lot of science for some science fiction novels, I think we need to go to the video game industry and challenge them. Make science literate video games. Not shooters, but games so exciting that still teach you principles. And I believe that's how you get to the American kids. But we've got to get to them. We've just got to get to them.
Well, if that's the only way we can get to them, that's a sad fact indeed.
Yep, but unfortunately, look, you know, you just there gets to be a point where you realize you pick your poison, and the poison is illiteracy or video games. And if the video games is the way to do it, then you do it. I mean, I try to tell my kid, do you want to read or do you want to play the video game? Well, the video game wins. But why can't we make the video game so stimulating and interesting that you pick up stuff from it?
When we get to the point where there is coconuts dropping from the trees in Chicago, much as it may seem to like a joke to the fellow who wrote this, so much on the planet will have changed. So many people will have been... Here comes the big one, folks. If you're listening, I hope you're listening. The displacement of human beings as sea level rises, people are going to have to seek new homes. They're going to move from point A to point B. And I know this is going to seem outrageous to you, but that is going to cause wars. There will be wars because of this. Do you agree?
Absolutely. Professor? Actually, I spent an hour on the phone with one of the New York newspapers today. Just, again, I had this book coming out. They read the book and said, you've got to be kidding. New York City, that's not going to happen. It's just the simple predictions of 4 feet by 2100, 2120. So, of course, it's going to happen. And it's not just the rise in sea level, but it's the storm surge. From those storms, you just had that typhoon go over. Why is it we call them typhoons in the Pacific and hurricanes in the Caribbean? Anyway, I've been through Pacific typhoons, and they are the scariest things.
Oh, they are. One of the things, Dr. Ward, is that, of course, when something begins when the genesis for it is way across the Pacific. You know, many of them are generated fairly close by, but many of them are generated way back east. And they've got a very long, long way to travel across a very warm Pacific. And so they can grow to immense size. I mean, just monster storms because the Pacific is so big.
Yeah, I had to go through one in New Caledonia and another in tropical Australia, and both times in ships. And it was just, people tell me all the time, oh, I never get seasick. And I said, well, you've never been in a typhoon in the Pacific, Beth. But those storms are just going to get worse.
Well, that's really already happening. The season back in the Caribbean is just beginning, the Atlantic season, and already it's been, from a, you know, like a Category 5 point of view, not that bad, but that is still ahead of us. It's going to be a rough season, and it's going to get rougher and rougher and rougher. People are already noticing this. And why is that happening? Why are the storms getting bigger? Answer, heat.
Mm-hmm.
Heat. That's it, folks. Heat. A typhoon or hurricane, these are ways, they're sort of nature's air conditioners for the planet. When there's too much heat, that heat is fuel for these storms, be they Atlantic or Pacific, and warm water, warm air, all of it, heat. And so you get bigger and more frequent storms. And that's what we're facing. And that's just the beginning. I don't know how we get through to people, Professor. I really worry about this because not only government, and certainly we would have expected more from the Obama administration than we've seen so far, a whole lot more. But I'm afraid they may be succumbing to, you know, the same financial pressures that we talked about a little while ago. I imagine would happen to any political entity. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know how to get through to people. And if we don't get through to people, it's going to be, if not already, too late.
Well, I'm going to challenge you briefly here. To my surprise, I just went back to the websites. This is the 11th time I've been on Coast to Coast, and I think 8 with you. I challenge you, Art, to come back more. I mean, we need you. I mean, I don't know what the politics of Coast to Coast is. I know it's probably a pain for you, but I certainly miss you on this show. George is great, but we need both of you guys. It's kind of voice of reason.
Well, thank you.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm just not the sort of person that sucks up, but I think we do need you, and we need you for these reasons. We have to get across this message.
You know, I hate to be sort of a negative kind of person, but I don't think we're going to get to these people. The level of disbelief, the level of anger. I mean, listen, I'm getting messages calling you and me communists. We're communists. For voicing such a... I'm sure you get emails like that, right?
All the time. Yep.
We're communists for saying that the globe is warming, that the temperatures are warmer than ever, despite, you know, like today's headline, you know, that... the warmest June in all of recorded Earth history. We're communists because of that.
Well, then I'm a communist.
Well, now see, somebody will take that statement, isolate it, and print it somewhere. Dr. Peter Ward admits he's a communist. You know, it will not be in context, but I guarantee somewhere somebody will trust me on this. It's just pure hatred, and I do understand it from an economic oil company political point of view. I understand that, but the average person, half of them out there, near half of them anyway, thinking that people who would talk about the kind of things we're talking about are communists, that's Dr. Ward, that's just outrageous, and already we're at another break point. So, surrounded by sea made up of 7,000 plus islands, the Philippine Islands, Southeast Asia, I'm Art Bell. Good morning, good evening. Good afternoon, literally for everybody. We're all around the planet, but we definitely own the night. That is in areas where there is night at this moment. Other areas, like this one, for example, where the sun is high in the sky and it's about 2:34 in the afternoon. There's a very interesting question brought up by John in San Jose, California. We'll get to in a moment. Please ask Peter, what is causing other planets in our solar system to heat up? And there's truth in that, and we'll tackle it or talk about it in a moment. Peter Ward, just so you know, once again, is not a communist, number one. He's a professor of biology, a professor of Earth and space sciences, an adjunct professor of astronomy at the University of Washington in Seattle. He's not a communist. He's principal investigator of the University of Washington node of the NASA Astrobiology Institute, which involves the leadership of over 25 scientists studying the possibility, probability, let's make that, of finding life beyond the Earth. He's also senior counselor of the Paleontological Society, was awarded an affiliate professorship at the California Institute of Technology. It's worth reminding you who you are listening to, and he will be back in a moment. Nobody, including myself, would suggest that we may not be in the midst of a natural cyclical change, as well as the man-made changes that are adding to whatever that might be. But John in San Jose brings up a good point. He says, please ask the professor what's causing the other planets in our solar system to heat up. And there's been a lot of news about that, Doctor, that other planets are heating as well, certainly Mars and other planets. What part do you think, what's going on with that?
Yeah, that's a very legitimate question. Look, none of us want to sort of rush to judgment. And going back to this global warming, this has been a lot of hard work for a long time. But the big fight has been in past years, has it been caused by gases that we humans are putting up? So is it really the effect of humanity, or could it be that the sun has increased the amount of radiation coming out? And so about 3 years ago, for the first time, there was the report that came out that said, hey, look, the planets, the other planets are also warming up, and we don't see any Volvos or cars or factories or greenhouse gases being produced there. Mm-hmm. So it must mean that what is happening here is that we are actually warming up because the sun is increasing its output. The sun, surely, this is theoretically possible. It goes through cycles, and we do know that over long periods of time, the sun continues actually to warm and will continue to warm until about, 8 billion years from now. It will expand over a few hundred billion years beyond the orbit of the Earth and heat us up. Well, that's a long way off, but nevertheless, the sun is getting warmer and warmer and warmer every single year. So, of course, all the planets. But the question becomes, how warm are the planets getting relative one to another? You know, if they're all warming at the same amount, but in fact, the Earth is warming hundreds to thousands of times faster than the other planets are. And the second thing is, really hard to take the temperature of a planet. Look, it's hard for us to take the temperature of this planet, but that's once true. You have a distant planet, what you're trying to do is you're using a telescope or you're using spectral analyses to try to see on the bounce back of these waves. Let's see, I've got to measure the equator, I've got to measure this, I've got to measure that, except it's just this tiny disk out there. Mm-hmm. So the science of it is very different, but the fact that we are warming so much faster than the others makes it irrelevant to say that the sun's doing it all. It's not. If something's warming us up a lot faster than the others, and what that something is are greenhouse gases.
Okay, but it's fair to say both things can be going on concurrently. We can be warming as a result of one sort or another of cyclical changes, which we know the Earth has gone through many times, and then lumped on top of that, what man is contributing. So that's certainly fair to say, right?
Yep, and the other side of the coin is that the Earth itself, the most significant form of heat we've had for a long period of time has been the interior of the Earth, and that's cooling. And so we continue to warm even though the central fires of the Earth themselves are running out of the radioactive material, and slowly over time that the Earth itself has been cooling from that internal heat. Yet, in spite of that, we still keep warming. So you've got other possibilities too. And just when you add it all together, it just really does look like greenhouse warming has really warmed us up over the last 200 or 300 years.
Looking around the planet, certainly Bangladesh would be about first on the list. If you fly to Bangladesh, it already looks like most of the country is underwater or sharing what little land there is with water. So it would go very, very quickly. What other areas would you name that would be in dire, fast trouble with ocean rise? And then we'll move to the safer places. But there's Bangladesh. What other areas would you worry about?
I would not buy real estate in Venice, pretty as it looks. Venice has to be the most endangered city on the planet. But unfortunately, the Dutch and the Belgians, the Low Countries, they're called the Low Countries, and boy, they are low, and they are in trouble. They're built up, and they have two big problems, Art. One is the rise of the sea. And once again, it's not just the sea, but the rising sea also lets the storms have a higher springboard, something called storm surge. I mean, that's right. Really what nailed New Orleans. So they've got that problem, but the other big problem for them is they've got rivers going right through them. If two front wars are terrible things, one front is the North Sea, which is encroaching on Holland and Belgium, but the other is that the fact that it's getting warmer means that it doesn't snow as much in the mountains anymore. In the winter, all the precipitation hitting the Alps is not turning to snow as it used to, but a lot of it at ever higher elevation is turning to rain. It used to be in Holland that you could have the bad winter storms and then you have the bad spring floods, but the two rarely coincided. But now you got the bad winter storms with the bad winter floods because you don't have snow in those mountains. It rains right out, the rivers fill up, and you've got rivers going right through. And it's that combination. They're building dikes on the sea, and they're building dikes against the rivers. And it's when the two intersect that you have the worst problems. That is ground zero right there. Bangladesh, Venice, and certainly the Low Countries are in the worst state for sea level rise.
And, of course, the island nations.
Yes, I shouldn't have forgotten that. They are the worst. I mean, Nauru and all of the low-lying atolls. Hats off to New Zealand. New Zealand has taken it upon itself as a country to take all of those low-lying islands in their region, at least, and take all the refugees. And that is something that the world is going to have to do more and more and more of. And the New Zealand said, yeah, you know, we see what's happening out here. And you're absolutely true. I should not have forgotten those.
Right. Yes, they're getting ready to evacuate some islands, as a matter of fact.
Yep.
If all of this really gets bad and people begin moving, mass migration, as I mentioned earlier, it's going to lead to war. Now, let's just imagine for a moment an attack on, say, Bangladesh by India with nuclear weapons. And one can imagine several other areas where nuclear exchanges can occur, but just imagine that one for a moment. Scientists talked about a nuclear winter. I wonder, is that a solution to global warming, nuclear winter?
Oh, I hope not. But there is a solution in that. It's somewhat in that vein, as you know. Paul Crutzen, who won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, suggested, I guess about 5 years ago now, that what we need to do is just dump massive quantities of sulfur particles in the atmosphere, and that this is the equivalent of Mount Pinatubo, the famous volcano, which really did lower the temperature of the Earth.
That's right.
In its Philippine eruption. Was that the 80s, 90s?
I think it was the 80s.
I thought, and it just was big enough. It was way worse than St. Helens.
No, maybe the 90s. I've got to look it up. Someone fast blast me.
Maybe it was 90s. I know a bunch of our people from my university went. I didn't. But it did change the temperature of the Earth. So Crutzen said, hey, let's salt the atmosphere with the equivalent of Mount Pinatubo ash. Let's put sulfur particles up there, aerosols. That would certainly lower the temperature of the planet. Unfortunately, look, one of the big crises right now is happening right off my coastline, Washington State. The ocean is getting more acid, and the acidification is coming because more and more carbon dioxide is being dissolved back into seawater. And when it does so, it increases acidity. If you take this this giant global engineering, a geoengineering project of lowering the temperature of the atmosphere, you're going to increase the salinity of the oceans and kill the plankton. Right now in the North Sea and further north in the Arctic areas, plankton that have calcareous shells, little tiny guys, they're actually little floating snails called pteropods. Their shells are dissolving off the soft parts because the oceans are so acid that it is removing the ability for calcium carbonate. It's like putting, we put in this beautiful marble floor filled with beautiful ammonite fossils when I redid my house some years ago, and my son at the time spilled a glass of orange juice. Well, that was the end of the beautiful polished limestone. It dissolved it away. Well, that's what's happening out in the oceans now. We're getting this nice acid from the global warming. So Crutzen's idea isn't going to work. Well, what about space mirrors? What about particles? What about other shades, sun shades up there? And this is certainly being discussed over and over and over again. I actually wrote an article trying to detail these and critique them and decide which is good and which is bad. And it always comes back down to the simple solutions, the ones that will work, are low-tech, not high-tech. And low-tech, such as painting your roof, and low-tech, burying charcoal in soil, putting iron in the middle of the Pacific to cause phytoplankton to bloom. This is, you don't need big machines. You need a great will and understanding that this is a problem that has to be solved.
So if there is a number one thing that we could do to begin changing the temperatures, you would say it would be what?
Lower the number of people on the planet. We've got to reduce the population over periods of time. That is it. I mean, it's it, you know. And the thing, here's the circularity of it all, is that to lower population growth, you need to increase standards of living of all people, because women with a higher standard of living have fewer kids. When you have fewer kids, you're going to lower the emissions. Global warming is going to go down, and we stabilize things. But to have a higher standard of living requires the ability for you to have access to more energy. Higher standard of living generally comes along with a car and a house and all the stuff. And all that stuff requires a power plant and requires a lot of carbon to go to the atmosphere. So this is the circularity. We increase standard of living all over the globe for all 9 billion of us. To do that, we will have to, I think, really end up melting the ice sheets, and up goes sea level.
Professor, what sort of case do you think that scientists could make in an appeal to the Vatican, let's say, to change their stance on birth control?
I was raised a Catholic. I was brought up in a Catholic household. I went to church every Sunday. And I continue to be outraged by the fact that the Catholic Church does not see what too many people is doing to this planet. There just has to be a case made by all religions that, look, you know, there's standards of living. Everybody has the right to a high standard of living instead of the way it is now. To do that, however, we have to remove somehow the burden of all these extra mouths, which require all this extra energy, which is warming our planet and causing the seas to rise.
Yes. Well, it's going to be a hell of a battle. It really is. Take this country that I'm in as an example. We're about 87% Catholic here. And thankfully, our new president, President Aquino, appears to be pro-birth control. But it's going to be a heck of a battle. It really is. You've got the church that is very, very powerful here. And I don't see what kind of appeal is going to work. I just don't think the Vatican's going to change the mind. The church is very, very fixated on this idea of no birth control, more Catholics, lots more Catholics.
That's a lot of souls. You got to have those souls out there, you know, it's producing souls. I don't know. There's a fantastic organization called TED, T-E-D, and they have some wonderful talks that are free. If you just Google TED, there's a fantastic talk about just global population rise and where it's taking place and how it's working. It's only like 20 minutes. It's really a very interesting sort of take on what's going on. And it just, again, it just breaks my heart that we have all these brand new mouths to feed, and every one of them is to require for us to burn more energy.
Sure.
And it's going to be coal and it's going to be oil. And that's the big two.
All right. We covered the most dangerous spots on Earth pretty well. Obviously, not everything about a warmer world is going to be bad. I mean, not literally everything. I mean, there are going to be some areas that are going to, I suppose, benefit in some way from a warmer world. So let's talk about the safest places.
Well, I'm going to shamelessly plug my book, The Flooded Earth, because I make the bold prediction, which is pretty simple. The two richest places on the planet in the 2100s are going to be Russia and Canada. And the reason being is that global warming is going to produce the wheat growing areas in those areas, in those two countries, to a greater extent than anybody else. The sad news about carbon dioxide rise, that higher CO2, you would think plants do better. Plants respire. They take in carbon dioxide. In more and more carbon dioxide-rich environments, plants should grow more. But the sad studies recently have shown that actually increasing CO2 levels reduces those crops that we want most. Corn and wheat and rice, all three of them, reduce their yield in much higher CO2. So we've got that whammy. And the second whammy is that by 2100, of course, we've got the 3 to 4 foot sea level rise, which is going to knock out at least 10% of food production right on the coastal areas. So it's those one-twos. Canada and Russia have really great northern wheat-growing areas, winter wheat, and they are going to increase the length of time because of the warmer conditions they can grow that wheat. They also have the second important thing. The whole 21st century is all about food and all about water. It's about good water that you can drink and that takes care of your crops, and it's about bad water, sea level rise coming up against your coastlines.
So,
both of them are positioned in great shape.
So, Middle America, which has been the the wheat belt, everything belt, we grow food for the world, that's going to shift north to Canada. But a lot more than that is going to shift, isn't it? In other words, where the food is, where the good water is, it's going to be where the political power rests as well, ultimately, isn't it? It's going to change a lot more than just where the food is grown.
Yes, and to that end, the greatest flashpoint in the world is going to be the triangle of China, Russia, and Pakistan. I'm sorry, China, India, and Pakistan, because right now the big fight is for the water coming out of the high mountains, the Himalayas, and who controls it and who's upriver. All three of those are huge population growth areas. All three need the water for energy, but they need it for their crops. The news, we just don't get real news here, and the news is that one part of China has, for the last 10 years, the greatest drought, the longest drought in Chinese history has been taking place in the regions closest to the Himalayas, and it's been ongoing for a decade because of climate change. And we've got this enormous problem with water coming to those three countries. Who's going to get it? The fight will be over water, and the fight will be over land. And that is the nature of the upcoming world.
And there's not much on the horizon that's going to change that, is there?
Well, there could be a miracle, Art. You and I know science does strange things. Look, a miracle could take place in Livermore, California, because that is where they're testing the hottest laser ever. If they can make the laser temperatures hot enough, the hope is fusion generation. If you have fusion power, you've got it. But you and I went through cold fusion. My friends at Caltech say this is the greatest bunch of nonsense ever, but the Caltechies hate people at Berkeley anyway, so I take it with some grains of salt, but nevertheless, please let it work. Or Harrison Schmitt, the guy that went to the moon, that says we need to go to the moon and get helium-3 because we can do our power plants off helium-3. Please let that work. Otherwise, it is coal, and when our president says there's clean coal, that's the worst oxymoron ever. There is no clean coal. What there is a whole bunch of coal. Coal is the cheapest form of power on the planet. As oil gets more and more expensive, coal stays cheap. There's just a whole bunch of it there.
Right. America has a lot of coal. Canada has a lot of coal. And I, for the life of me, cannot understand. I really can't, Professor, why that's the direction we're going to move after the last of the easily available. Well, look, the easily available oil, what am I saying? It's already gone. We're going to move toward coal. Is that where we're headed? Is that a good place to be going? I don't know. From Manila in the Philippines, I'm Art Bell.